From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made with a letter from Paul to the Ephesians. The letter was a call for unity in the early church, and it's a message that may resonate with parishioners in many churches across the country today. In Rochester, that letter was the foundation of a sermon just yesterday by Reverend Dr. Michelle Bogue-Trost, the new senior minister at Asbury First United Methodist Church. Speaking to her congregation, she said, "Christians never fight, right?" It was a cheeky comment, of course, but with it, she asked her congregation to think about the value of a common purpose, especially in a political and social landscape that can often be defined by anger. "We're allowed to be angry about injustice and hardship," she said. "But spite and viciousness, ugliness," she said, "that's different than righteous anger." Asbury is one of the most progressive churches in Rochester, one that has embraced inclusion in many ways. LGBTQ rights and related issues have divided the global Methodist church and led to a split within the denomination. Here in Rochester, former Asbury senior minister, Reverend Dr. Stephen Cady, served as an outspoken advocate for the LGBTQ plus community. As you've heard on this program, the church hosted its first same-sex marriage in January. Cady and his family moved to Texas this summer, but parishioners say he laid the foundation for growth for years to come. And that's where Reverend Dr. Bogue-Trost comes in. As a gardener, she understands growth. She says she has learned that peace comes with one who learns to bloom where one is planted. Born in the South, she comes to Rochester by way of California, Michigan, Louisiana, Alabama, most recently Endicott, New York. Planted in Rochester as of July 1st, she is already making an impact. And this hour, we're talking with Reverend Dr. Michelle Bogue-Trost about her background and her vision for the future of the church and its role in the community. It comes in a time when more Americans are saying religion's role in American life, or at least in theirs, personally, it's shrinking. So what does that all mean? Welcome, Reverend Dr. Michelle Bogue-Trost, senior minister at Asbury First United Methodist Church. It's great to have you. Thank you for being
here.
It's
great to be here. Thank you so much.
You have big shoes to fill, although you're going to bring your own shoes. I think Reverend Dr. Cady took his own shoes with him to Texas.
I think he must have.
I think probably
so. I wouldn't fit them anyway.
Yeah, no. I mean, everyone's got to carve their own path. And we talked to Stephen many times on this program. We've talked to the couple that he married in January as the first same-sex marriage. I happen to know them personally and their neighbors. And so it's kind of a small town, big town here, I'm sure. But you want to talk a little bit about where you grew up first and if you ever thought you'd be working in Rochester, New York, having an interview like this?
I never thought I'd end up in Rochester, no. I grew up all over the place. My father was in the Air Force, and so we moved. I've been itinerant my whole life. I did a lot of my growing up in Montgomery, Alabama, which is what I call my hometown, because, high school, college, friends, set, all of that. Moved up to Troy, New York in 1988 and began ministry in 1996.
1996.
In what was the Troy Annual Conference of the United Methodist Church.
Why did you feel called to ministry?
I have no idea why. I ask God that all the time.
Really?
Yeah. Because, you know, God picks unexpected people in unexpected places to speak truth and to live the gospel and to preach it. And most of us who've ever had a call to ministry have said, "Why me? I don't understand. Surely you meant somebody else. Surely you're, you know, looking behind me as you're pointing at me." But then you sit with the idea, you pray with the idea, you live into the idea, and you live into that identity.
Did you have any, in those early days, from 96 onward, did you have any imposter syndrome? Did you have any moments where you went like, are they sure that this is what they want me to be
all
doing?
The time.
Did you?
Yes. And when I received the call to come to Asbury First, that was running large. The sense of, are you sure you mean me?
Well, I can tell you that, so we saw Stephen and Emily and their family this summer, kind of a little going away party. And there was a lot of talk the spring into summer, especially, you know, who it was going to be, because Stephen and his family left a serious mark. And I remember just when a neighbor said, we got her. Like, it was a lot of excitement about your arrival, not because you have to be anything but yourself, but they were very excited about who you are. So why do you think you have so thrilled Asbury First United?
You know, I'm still sussing that out, but I think that I bring an energy for ministry. Stephen and I are friends, and we're very different people. We're very different pastors. We're very different preachers. And so I bring a different pastoral identity to this role. I'm eager to try new things. I'm eager to see what context, how context affects ministry here for me in my own experience, having been in two very different places in New York State prior to this. And I'm excited to make connections with folks inside the congregation and folks outside the congregation.
Do you think you had advantage is the wrong word, but a benefit in your own experience having had this itinerant life and lived in so many places?
Yes. I think I've learned resilience. I've learned the whole bloom where you're planted thing. I've learned that, you know, every space is different. Folks who think that all churches are the same are missing the point. They're not, and they're not supposed to be. And so being able to experience different church contexts, from churches with four people in them to churches with, you know, 2,200 members now, is such a breadth of opportunity and knowledge and experience possible. And I'm excited about that.
I want to talk to you a little bit about your style, and then we're going to talk about some of the issues that have really confronted your church in really tough ways, but just about your style. So everyone has their own style.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to tell the story because I'm not here to talk about me. I don't talk a lot about my own sort of faith path, but I just bring this up because it was a memory and is something that was so profound in my own personal experience. So I was baptized Presbyterian in a family that didn't really go to church very much. I had an aunt who converted to UU, and when I was in high school, I wanted to solve the mysteries of the universe as
sure.
a teenager does.
As you do.
As you do. And, you know, I ended up converting on my own to Catholicism. I did some youth group leading stuff in high school. Some listeners are probably going like, really? and then I kind of drifted. I read the Bible cover to cover in college and found myself drifting and kind of moved toward atheism. And then I called something spiritual existentialism because I wanted to sound high-minded.
Well, it does sound very fancy.
It does sound
it?
Very yeah. fancy, yeah. And then as I get older, I find myself more spiritual, if not fully denominational. All of which is to say, what I remember of maybe the most was when I was in college and went to a Catholic service and in Athens, Ohio, and was told by, I mean, I don't even remember the hierarchy of the leadership. I mean, I was there for so little. But the priest told us during a sermon that only God truly loves you, that God is true love. But not even your own family loves you the way God does. That's not real love. Only God is real love. And I was like, I like put my hand up. I was like, I don't want to interrupt you, but like, really? Like, is this really the right? And so I spoke to him later, and he said that modern Americans need a firm view of God. And I felt myself pushed away by it. And then I watched the Catholic Church really evolve from Benedict, who was much kind of, I hate to say it, but that priest reminded me of Benedict, who was more of a, we'll take a smaller church if it's a purer church, and I'm summarizing.
Mm-hmm.
And Francis is a little bit more of a, let's bring everybody in that we can, and let's not, you know, be as strict as Benedict. I bring that up because I want to understand where you are with all of this. I mean, how firmly strict do you feel like you want people to be walking in the door, understanding God, understanding Scripture, understanding the expectations? How open do you want the doors? Are you okay with a smaller, purer church? Do you want a big, broad tent? What do you want?
I'd have to say I'm on Team Francis.
Team Francis in that way? Yeah.
Yeah. I think that church is not a narrow gate, right? I think that church is an open door, a big tent. There's room for everybody in it. It may not be, you know, individual churches that have different ideas about who's in, who's out. You know, we fight about that all the time. All the mainline denominations have been fighting about that. But in my own sense of what church is and what church needs to be, it's that we need to have the doors all the way open, every single door, all the windows too. And if we've got people sitting on the windowsills to hear something that touches them, that teaches them more about God, That's our job as church. It's not to say, well, you have to pass this test before you get in, or mm-hmm. you have to do these things before you get in. It's come on in, and together we'll figure out your next steps as you grow in relationship with God and neighbor.
Why do you think fewer Americans are choosing to, first of all, go to a church physically, but also to align mm-hmm. themselves and how they self-identify with it?
I think there's a lot of answers to that question. Primarily, in my humble opinion, I think it's because church has been fighting for far too long over really stupid things. The church has been far too exclusive for far too long. People have been hurt by church, wounded and abused by church, and the people in it. I'm speaking very generally here. Or their family members have, and it's not right. It's cognitive dissonance. How do we preach God, peace and grace, yet exclude and turn away, or say you must meet these benchmarks in order to be, I don't know, loved by God? For me, God's love is, it just is. There's no earning it or losing it. It exists. We are all in and surrounded by God's love, which runs through all of us. We can choose to accept it or choose not to accept it, but that doesn't change the fact that it's there. And to be beloved of God is the first step to growing in faith, growing in relationships. So I think for folks who've been hurt, for folks who've experienced hypocrisy in the church, because, you know, we're full of hypocrites. People who say one thing and do another. That's what my whole sermon was about yesterday. And the fact that church has rules, right? Church is on Sunday mornings, for the most part. Church has standard traditions that if you know, and if you don't, you feel like terribly like an outsider when you walk through the doors. Church is not speaking the language of younger generations. And again, very broad picture, main lines predominantly I'm talking about. We're learning, we're catching up, but we're not reaching people exactly where they are. We're still in large part expecting people to come to us.
How do you reach the youngest generation of adults, teenagers, young adults?
That is different in every context. Mm-hmm. I think social media is key. I think that being outside your building, outside your space, being in the community and saying, you know, hey, I'm from Asbury First and, you know, I'm glad to meet you. Being present for people where they are.
I want to talk about community because mm-hmm. one of the reasons that I have, as I get older, I have a lot more affinity and affection for organized religion, mm-hmm. even if I can't fully get my head around it myself in terms of a belief system. But the structure of community is so, I think, at risk in many ways. We are ostensibly more connected than ever, and yet we are less connected in community. And that's not just church, of course. I mean, that's in a lot of different things. I mean, there's fewer kids playing organized sports, and there's, you know, fewer community groups and things like that. But I see church or take organized religion sort of as a monolith, mm-hmm. which is unfair, but for a moment, let's do that. I see it as this great possible benefit, what you're describing, what I've seen at Asbury, what I see at Spiritus, what I see at a lot of places. And I also hear you when you say that a lot of people have been harmed and even abused by organized religion. And that might make them think this cannot be a place of community.
Or safety.
For me. Or safety.
Yeah.
For me. So some of it is unfair because, you know, the Methodist Church is not the Catholic Church, it's not your local mosque, it's not your temple. I mean, every place has its own community.
Yes.
But you may be damaged by reputation or by how people are perceiving organized religion as either a positive place of community or a place of harm. generally speaking, do you think organized religion is still a positive place of community?
On the whole, yes.
On the whole, yeah.
I do. Yeah. And I think we're a culture that starved for a community. Pandemic sent us all home, mm-hmm. sent us all away, sent us all on the other side of screens. And in many ways, we're recovering from that. You know, people are venturing back out. And some are coming back to church. Some are not and never will. But it is so easy to stay just in one place and not take the step, not take the step to meet people or to risk community. I mean, 'cause community can be wonderful, but community also has its own aches and pains and pitfalls and bumpy places. And for a culture that's living in fear and anger, we don't want to risk it. You know, we don't want to risk being hurt, being harmed, even if it's not happened to us or anyone we know. We just hear those things and we're just not even going to try. Being able to form connections on personal level, I think is so much more important now than it ever has been. Reconnecting people. And I think that church is a built-in way to do that. Faith communities are. I don't just mean church. All faith communities are a way to do that. You're united for a common purpose, that is to celebrate God, to celebrate the love of God, and to learn how to live like Jesus in the Christian tradition.
Talking to Reverend Dr. Michelle Bogue-Trost, who is the senior minister at Asbury First United Methodist Church, since July 1st, is that right?
Yes.
It's when you planted your garden here in Rochester.
And, so to speak.
And, you know, this has been a place where the leadership of Asbury in recent years has decided to be very public and to lead on this question of a possible worldwide split in the Methodist Church over LGBTQ plus rights. And, you know, we have had Methodist ministers who are not from Asbury on this program who felt differently and were mm-hmm. willing to leave and mm-hmm. felt they did not want to go down the road of equal marriage and the like. Can you take me through, first of all, just your general view on the split, how damaging that has been, and where you stood on it first, when you were really first aware that this could really split the Methodist Church worldwide, and what you were thinking about that?
I've been a delegate to the United Methodist General Conference since 2020.
That's usually
not
overseas.
2020, 2004, sorry, that's 20 years.
Usually overseas?
No, it's usually in the U.S.,
it's in the
which
United
is
States. Okay.
A problem in and of itself.
Okay.
But always on the side of removing harmful and exclusionary language from our polity document, mm-hmm. from the Book of Discipline. Every 4 years, going to try to get that out. Being frustrated every 4 years by the fighting and the awful awfulness. Going home and being just sick for a week at the hate and the harm happening on General Conference floors with debates and speeches and attacks and terrible behavior for Christians. So something had to give, and that was obvious. I didn't know through these last 20 years whether it would be, for me myself, individually, whether I would need to leave the denomination. For progressives in my part of the conference and the progressives all over the country that I knew, do we have to leave? Do we have to leave and start a new Methodist church in order to have an inclusive denomination? And then in 2016, 2019, that decision was made in reverse. The very conservative folks, the folks who could not live under the broad tent, the folks who could not countenance taking exclusionary language out of the discipline, no matter how recent it was, decided they could not deal with us anymore. And hence the disaffiliations, the pieces put in place for folks to leave. And I think the difference at this general conference was palpable. There was peace. And there were disagreements, but they weren't vitriolic. They weren't aggressive and harmful in nature. That gave me incredible hope, even before any of the legislation passed. It just gave me hope. It's bittersweet. We've lost colleagues and friends and neighborhood churches and all of that. And so that grief is palpable as well.
Can I ask about some of the people who did choose to leave, mm-hmm. and who couldn't countenance, you know, a church that could host a gay wedding, for example?
Right.
They point to passages in the Bible, mm-hmm. and they make a very literal case that they are right, that this is the word of God, and that it is you who is making
yes.
a mistake, even a sinful mistake. What do you yes. tell them?
That there are 7 verses they tend to use for those arguments.
Yeah.
And there's a whole lot of other verses in the Bible that speak of love and grace. And I got to weigh in on the balance of the scripture that talks about peace and grace and love and justice. And if I'm wrong, I'd rather err on the side of love and grace and justice.
And that hasn't swayed your colleagues, I guess, who chose to leave. But you describe a more peaceful moment, at least.
Mm-hmm.
Are your doors still open for the people who did choose to maybe go to different congregations that did choose to leave but might think, you know what, I drive past Asbury First and maybe I'll go someday. The door's open there?
The door's open. The door's always open to everyone. Where I draw the line is that the moment you start causing harm to someone in the congregation or outside the congregations, we're going to have a conversation about that, about whether this is really a place that you feel comfortable. I'm not going to turn anybody away just because I think they're super conservative, or it's only when harm happens that we have to enter into dialogue about that.
Well, it seems in your time so far in Rochester that I'll ask you this. Do you consider yourself a blunt speaker? Are you blunt?
I'm forthright.
Forthright.
Forthright, I've been told
okay.
many times.
Okay. You know, I ask because I'm thinking about this idea of righteous anger versus, let's see how you put it, the difference between viciousness, meanness, and true righteous anger. Let me start there. What's the difference in your mind?
Righteous anger is standing up for injustice. It's the Micah 6:8 passed it, to love justice, to walk humbly with God. When you love justice, you have to stand up and speak up in places where injustice is happening. And very often it takes anger to get us there, to the place where we're willing to risk things to speak on behalf of those who are the last and the least and the left behind. The ugliness has no place in Christianity. And I say that, and I told the congregation yesterday that when I say ugly, I say it in the Southern sense. It has nothing to do with how you look. It's how you act. It's how you behave. It's how you treat people in common space. When you cause harm, I think righteous anger, fighting for justice, fighting to help people's voices be heard, trying to figure out how to formulate that thought, that is a powerful force that is godly, I think. It's what causes the Martin Luther Kings to stand up. It's what causes the Gandhis to stand up, because there is anger at systems and powers and principalities that are injuring, oppressing, harming. There is a place for that kind of anger. But the personal anger, the personal attacks, vindictiveness, the way we treat each other in our anger is the problem.
Do you? Well, I guess we're going to see how blunt you want to be. I feel like in the last decade, we have seen more personal nastiness.
Yes.
Elevated and weaponized and celebrated.
Yes.
And I see it in politics, but I also see it co-opted by politicians, even in the name of religion.
Yes.
You see that too?
I do.
Are you surprised?
I'm surprised, but I'm not shocked by it. I think that faith, Christianity, has been used as a tool since the beginning. I think that once Christianity became the state religion of Rome, persecution began. Not of the Christians, but those who had been persecuting them. We've done it our whole history. There's ugly history of pain and hurt in our faith tradition. How do we reclaim the grace? How do we reclaim those spaces where God speaks in still small voices? I don't think that the use of immediately gratifying send buttons.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's harm. To have so many available ways to put just a flash opinion out there, to speak harm without reflecting on it, without even having to confront the person you're harming, is a dangerous path.
I don't think Jesus would have been on Twitter.
Well, he might have been, but he might have been saying, like, let's go to Simon the leper's house for dinner. Meet there, 7 o'clock. Right? It would not have been, you are damned and going to hell.
Yeah. But I don't like the way it makes what it does to me. Like, it's easy for me to be like, well, Twitter's bad. I think it is bad. But I mean, like, I'm not like holier than thou. I don't like who I become when I'm on it.
Fair.
And so I see a lot of people, and I was going to say young people, but I mean,
no,
the interesting thing about social media is there's all these age stratifications, you know, like, I mean, if you're under 40, you're legally not allowed to be on Facebook, but you know, right. Stuff like that. So it's not just young people. It's a new way of being able to communicate, as you say, so instantly and so facelessly often.
Yes.
I think, so when we talk about the disconnect that you described and really kind of rooted more in the pandemic, I think it is really sort of toxified even more by how faceless these online communications are.
And
we don't even feel like we know someone. We're just going to dunk on them.
Right.
Like, for what? Why are we doing this? So, I mean, I joke that I don't think Jesus would be on Twitter. I mean, it would be fascinating to meet Jesus in 2024. I'm going to ask you a few of those questions in a moment. We're talking to the Reverend Dr. Michelle Bogue-Trost, who is the senior minister at Asbury First United Methodist Church, and she is generous with her time. She's only been officially on the job for just over a month. But to kind of bring this home a little bit here, how political do you let yourself be on the job, and how political does your congregation want you to be?
Well, the answer to the second question, I don't know yet, because
okay.
I've been
okay.
there for a month.
Okay.
For myself, I don't think, well, I mean, there are strict rules about how far you can go politically.
Urge people to vote.
You can or encourage people to vote, but you can't encourage
who to vote for?
For whom to vote. No, you can't.
Can you talk about who you vote for?
Can I talk?
Is that like part of the, I don't even know exactly what the rules are.
That verges that's
like people might guess, but it's like you don't even need to really say it, right?
It's tiptoeing on
the
line.
Let's not even go there.
So the way I preach politics, I did some of that yesterday. The way I preach politics is to say, what is the Christian metric for what we're seeing, what we're hearing in the world, what people are saying, what the political situation is? What is the Christian ethic? What is the Christ-like thing? What is the Christ-like piece of this platform or that platform or whatever? I don't need to mention names. I don't need to quote press conferences or, you know, rallies. I don't need to do that because the material is all out there. Again, it's all instant, right? We all know everything everybody says. And then we know all the extra stuff that people say, people said, all of that. We have it. The important part for faith communities is to say, where does this line up with our value system? Where does this, for Christians, line up with what Jesus would say or do? And I really don't want to get into the WWJD thing all over again, but how does this platform, how does this line of thinking, how does this speech line up with the values of justice and mercy and grace and peace? And when we can look at that honestly and clearly, I think the way becomes clearer. If this political party is not working to feed people who are hungry, if this political party is not working for justice on all levels of society, is that really Christ-like? Do I want to play that move in my future?
Yeah, I think that's fair, interesting and fair framing. Here's what surprises me maybe the most of all of these recent developments. We saw, I mean, there's a lot of different shades of being what it means to be Christian, I guess.
Oh, yes.
You know, of course. But we saw over the last two generations, a Republican Party built on, you know, Ronald Reagan would call it, you know, three legs of a stool, and one of them was U.S. Christians. Mm-hmm. And, but for the last decade, their avatar has been someone who laughs at religious people. I mean, this is pretty well documented by people who know him. You know, doesn't read any books, definitely hasn't read the Bible. I'm not trying to be like snarky. I'm just mm-hmm. observing.
Right. I mean,
the people know him, say he doesn't read books. And when he does speak about religion, it's in the most vindictive. In fact, in his own writings, has said that revenge is one of his key values.
Right.
He talks about so he talks about Christianity in a very vindictive eye for an eye lens, that just to me it almost has nothing in common with a historical Jesus.
McKay, I completely agree.
McKay Coppins is a political writer. He wrote the recent biography of Mitt Romney, and he wrote a piece for The Atlantic a couple of weeks ago in which he analyzed every prayer said before a Trump rally in this election season, analyzed all of them. And one of the really interesting things that he found in this cycle was, if you go back to 2016 and even 2020, there was a lot of talk of Cyrus. There was a lot of talk that, well, Donald Trump is not a very Christian person, but Christians viewed him, evangelicals viewed him, as a tool to do God's will, even if he himself, you know, Cyrus, he wasn't, okay, he's a tool. And McKay Coppins says that is out the window now. People talk about him as if he is the most Christ-like figure
yes.
in modern times.
That rhetoric has escalated.
It's changed.
Yeah, it has.
And so, you know, as someone who has your job, does that make you uncomfortable?
Oh, it makes me wildly and horribly uncomfortable.
Okay.
I think it's co-opting a Christian-ish message in order to gain evangelical and fundamentalist votes. And I think it's a tragic, horrifying distortion of the message of Christ.
I guess I won't ask you if you think Christ would have actually been like a communist, but if he was alive today, I don't think he would have a large house. Don't think he would be a CEO of a Fortune 500 company. This is a guy, the historical Jesus that we know, you know, as far as we know, the person who existed. For listeners who don't think he was divine, just take the historical figure. This was a guy who was not about material possession.
No.
And the modern avatar of evangelical Christianity has a gold-plated stroller for a baby conceived while he was having an affair with a porn star.
Yeah.
It's a weird time.
It is strange and fascinating times. And
it's a weird time.
Terribly horrifying.
So, but I guess all of which is to say, you feel like you can address parts of this pretty directly. You don't run afoul of the rules, but you're mm-hmm. willing to speak forthrightly.
Yes. Powers and principalities have always been the subject of Christian conversation. Jesus talks about powers and principalities when he talks about Caesar. Paul, who basically invented Christianity, talks about powers and principalities and how the Christian life is in opposition. I am aghast when I read justifications for harm and oppression using Christian rhetoric. And I cannot think that's where Jesus is. You were saying, would he have a big house or drive a big car? There was a song, Ray Stevens.
Range Rover, Jesus in a Range Rover.
Yeah. There was a song way, way back, Ray Stevens sang about, would Jesus wear a Rolex on his television show? You know, at the height of TV evangelists. And that's, I think we're looking at that same scenario.
Prosperity,
just in
gospel,
a different,
yeah.
And trying to find Jesus through all of that and clearing through all the murk and muck around Christianity or the use of Christianity or the manipulation of Christianity is hard work. And that, you know, that's hard to do solo. That's why I come back to church as community as being a place where we can work through these things together, where we can listen and critically engage with issues that are paramount for us in our lives the rest of the week.
One other note on this before we're happily going to move on to some other things. I've been a little uncomfortable lately about some of the rhetoric around some of the political language that has been in vogue in the last month. And frankly, it's a word that might have elevated Governor Tim Walz to the Democratic ticket. He was the first one to really sort of publicly say that he thought a lot of what he heard from Donald Trump and J.D. Vance was weird. and that became a word that all the Democrats were using. But I was uncomfortable that if it was being ascribed to people who vote that way. Because and he actually clarified this in a recent interview with the New York Times, where he said that he doesn't feel that way at all about the voters. He feels that way about the people who are trying to manipulate the voters. And he's trying to take down some of the power that is kind of stacked up when we start thinking in these really big, kind of scary terms. He said, no, mostly they're kind of weird, and it would be weird if they lived next door to you. You know, the way he put it was, can you envision these guys coming home from work and throwing a Frisbee with a dog and rubbing their belly? And if you can't, that's kind of weird, because that's what most people do. Most people work hard. They love their pets. They love their kids. They love their communities. And I at least found some comfort in that clarification. And I thought about Molly Ivins, who used to write about voters vis-a-vis the people who manipulate voters. So when you think about what makes you uncomfortable now about the way Christianity is described in some quarters, how do you feel about the way the people who call themselves Christian and vote that way and go to those rallies and chant those things? Do you feel like differently about them than you do about the powerful people leading those movements?
I do. I think people are vulnerable. We've isolated ourselves enough that we make ourselves terribly vulnerable to whatever comes our way. Mm-hmm. If we're the only ones listening, if we're sitting in an echo chamber and we're listening only to one thing, we're completely isolated. We have no way to critically engage. And I think that folks who are sort of blindly swallowing, and it doesn't matter which side, any side of any campaign, the folks who just blindly accept what their candidate is saying without some serious engagement, serious critical thinking, serious conversation with people, I think they're missing on the power and the potential of what it means to live in a democratic nation, in a democratic society, in a nation where all of our votes count, where we're all part of the bigger picture. And when we've isolated and pulled back and sat in our echo chambers for long enough, we tend to start thinking we're the only ones out here. And these folks have to be just what we want them to be. And I think the ones who are manipulating that's harmful. That's causing harm. That's oppressing in its own way. But I think that the folks who are in those spaces are hungry for something right and something good. I mean, it's a tremendous mission field.
Yeah. No, part of the reason I ask is I wanted to understand how you think about this and see if that kind of dovetails with how. So some of the work I do is just understanding how people form beliefs and how we have discourse with each other and mm-hmm. whether we're willing to even talk to each other or live
right.
near one another.
Right.
And I don't think most people go to bed at night thinking they're on the wrong side of history.
No, I'm pretty sure they don't.
I've said many times, people don't go to bed at night thinking, I was a bad person today, but I got away with it. I think some people do, not very many. I think most people think, I vote the way I do. I believe the way I do. I act in my community the way I do because I believe that this is the right thing.
Yes.
You know, and they form that belief for a variety of reasons.
Most well-intentioned,
yeah.
I don't think the average person is malicious.
No, I think
or malevolent.
I think there's a
way.
Real peril in the way we can convince ourselves, well, those people are just bad.
Right.
I don't believe that goes very far, and I don't think that's helpful.
It's another product of isolation.
That's interesting.
When you're not engaging with people regularly who may or may not agree with you, you're losing that sense of, you know, multifaceted humanity that we all have. You're losing the ability to say, I know you think this, but why? Let's have a conversation about that.
So can I bring it back to Asbury then?
Yeah.
Because, you know, you're coming into Asbury at this time where there has been the split in the Methodist Church. And in some ways, that's been very painful, but it also in other ways, it is more peaceful right now. It's less outward rancor. Things have kind of settled. But that might make for a little bit more of a homogenous community, just in terms of, and I'm not saying, well, hey, we should want the people who don't want, you know, the gay couple next door to get married. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, I think you probably want them in the door. You want to keep talking to everybody, right?
Yes.
I'm not trying to equally weight how I see values or beliefs. I'm simply saying we, as a society, whether it is the media we consume, whether, as you point out, where we choose to live, how we interact with one another, where we go to church or don't go to church, it is very easy just to be of like everything. So racial, socioeconomic, belief systems, it's pretty easy to figure out how to never really be challenged or
yes.
around anything that's different.
Right.
And how do you make sure Asbury is a place that fosters a garden where, you know, we have strong values and that those will not be compromised, but there will be some diversity of ideas, beliefs, backgrounds, et cetera. Does that make sense?
It does. I'm learning as I work into my time here that Asbury's full of all sorts of different philosophies and thoughts and different kinds of people and all from different backgrounds and different theologies even. And it's fascinating. It's fascinating to be in that, but also to articulate it and point it out. To say, this is what church should be. We're all here to grow in our relationship with God, to love our neighbor, to live like Jesus. We're all here to do that. We all have slightly different ideas about how to get there, and we're not always going to agree. But there are wonderful teachings in the scriptures about how not to agree together. And it's a rich opportunity. And we have to keep articulating it and saying, this is what we want. This is the desired goal. We want folks who are all over the map because that's what the kingdom of God looks like.
What do you fear the most at this point in your life?
Wow. What do I fear the most? I don't have a lot of fears. I fear...
Would that have been different 20 years ago?
Probably. But I'm entering a wiser age, I think.
Aging is, in many ways, as my 12-year-old has told me, boy, Dad, aging sucks. Well, sometimes. But in other ways, it lends a kind of comfort with oneself.
With oneself and with the world around you. You know, things are things. Things are bad. Things are good. Things are always going to be bad or good. Not any amount of striving on my part is going to change some things in this world. And I'm okay with that. What I fear is the proliferation of hate, the proliferation of harm, because it breaks my heart to see someone else's life or heart be broken. Is that fear? I don't know. It may just be coming to terms with the reality of the world.
Sadness and melancholy. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How long do you think you can be in Rochester with this itinerant life you've had? What does Rochester look like for you?
Well, I have no idea. We're appointed 1 year at a time.
One at a time.
One at a time. And so that's what we have to do, is take it one at a time.
Is there like an ideal in your mind? Do you think, hey, 10 years would be great?
No. I've had different tenures in each of the churches I've served, and for different reasons, each of those was the right amount of time. And it's the context, it's the people, it's what we can do together. And when that day comes when we can't do much more together, that's the time to start saying, well, I wonder how long this needs to be.
What was your first impression of Rochester?
Oh, the city or the church?
I guess both.
I think we are, my family's entranced with the city. We do love Rochester so far, what we've seen, what little we've seen of it with all the settling in and starting up at work. Lovely people. I mean, I stop in the grocery store and people are just kind and polite. And, you know, excuse me, I need to get there. Oh, sure, sure. You know, just kindness all over the place. Granted, I haven't been every place in Rochester. I'm told there are unkind people in Rochester, too. I don't know. The church is full of loving, genuinely friendly, caring, active people who all, I think, to some degree or another, want to live the Jesus way in the world and are happy doing that together and want very much for other people to experience that.
Help my 12-year-old with a question. He said, what's the difference between a Methodist and a Catholic? All right. All right, Reverend. Help a 12-year-old wants to understand, why are you a Methodist?
Well, I'm a United Methodist, actually.
Why are you a United Methodist?
I am a United Methodist because I really get John Wesley's groove about social holiness and personal holiness, that you can't have one without the other. You can't just be all pious and religious and not do anything for anybody else. And you can't also live in the space where you're only doing for other people and you're not growing in your own faith. So that's Wesley's jam that I liked and live in, and was delighted to discover that I was a Methodist when I didn't know I really was. You could go into logistical things. The Roman Catholics have 7 sacraments. We have 2. Less to remember.
I think your first answer, though, is a little, somewhat, at least to me, about works, acts, you know, the idea of what one's responsibility is. Mm-hmm. Do you have a responsibility to a community? Do you have a responsibility to take gifts that you have been given,
right,
and to share those gifts?
Yes, and Wesley would say yes.
Wesley would say yes. I think, I do not speak for Jesus, but I think he'd say yes.
I do too.
Do you think, maybe I'll close with this. Do you think that, you know, if we could sit down and have lunch with Jesus now, he would be saddened by what he sees, or he would be heartened by a lot of what he sees?
Both. I really think both. Because there are still stunning examples of loving kindness in the world. There are still amazing examples of people being truly good and doing good. And I think he would find his home there with that tribe. But I think he would be heartbroken at the way his name is used to hurt and exclude.
Do I once in a while hear a little bit of a Southern drawl from you? Can you do it? Do you have more? I'm not asking you to perform it. I'm saying, like, because I lived in West Virginia for all of a year and a half, and I still feel like I can slip.
You still say y'all, don't you?
A little. I could do it. I could do it with some authenticity.
Well, and I love what some language it gives me, having that sort of heritage or upbringing. I know, for example, that Jesus, most of the time, is not just saying you, he's saying y'all. And very often he's saying, all y'all.
All y'all.
Which means everybody better be doing this thing. So it's given me language, the language of ugliness and righteousness.
So 45 seconds for Rochesterians who've never lived in the South. What do we get wrong when we stereotype the South too much?
Oh, I will tell you, pecans. It's pecans. My grandmother had 23 pecans? Acres of pecan trees.
Are those like pecans?
They are pecans.
I see. I see. Is there...
You also get, I think, a stereotype of laziness, a stereotype of bigotry, and that's not universal, just like it's not universal that folks in the Northeast are all, you know, open and unprejudiced.
Well said. And 20 seconds. When you found out you were coming to Rochester, you thought what?
Oh, my word. It was completely unexpected.
And a happy?
And happy.
And a happy occurrence?
Yeah.
This hour has flown by.
Yes, it has.
And I'm really grateful for it.
I am too. Thank you for having me.
And I want you to know, public radio here, we try to have conversations with leaders across spectrums, all kinds of different faith backgrounds. We may invite you again.
Love
maybe one-on-one, maybe with your colleagues across faiths.
Great.
Please come.
I'd love to.
Thank you very much. That is the Reverend Dr. Michelle Bogue Trost, who is the senior minister at Asbury First United Methodist Church. Lovely conversation there. And from all of us at Connections, thank you for listening on this Monday afternoon. We're back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.